From Entebbe to Washington, D.C., Jay Bruder's research focuses on the independent companies that recorded R&B, gospel, and country music in Washington, D.C. during the 40s and the 50s. His work has been published at dcrecords.org, in Blues and Rhythm Magazine in England, and in Sweden, American Music Magazine. This morning, right here in America, he'll trace the sparsely documented relationships among influential independents in the hopes of finding forgotten East Coast connections. Jay?
Thank you, David. And you know, it's a real pleasure to be speaking here, and especially on a Saturday, because you know you're talking to the truly dedicated. So thank you all very much. And speaking of friends and dedicated friends, I need to thank Harold Shackelford, Kip Lornell, Pete Grandisa, Dan Kuchakian, Alan Sutton and Dave Barron, Billy Vera, and Dick Spotswood for their help in putting this presentation together. As a little bit of an introduction, I'll just have to say that there's been a bit of a rivalry between Washington and New York, and it started in about this period. And if I could ask Marty to get queued up here, we're going to play a short selection that Dave has generously provided to us, and I'm going to read it first so that you can hear it first time through. This is a cylinder recorded in the early 1890s in Washington, and it says, "The following band selection, Sousa's latest musical hit, The King Cotton March, played for the Columbia Phonograph Company of Washington, D.C. Marty, track one, please.
Following band selection, Sousa's latest musical hit, The King Cotton March, was played for the Columbia Phonograph Company of Washington, D.C.
Now, we know that Emil Berliner was working in Washington a few years later, and his venture was short-lived as well. David has generously provided these illustrations that just barely show Washington etched onto the surface of the disc to show where they were recorded. By 1904, Berliner was gone, but there was a legacy of published sheet music in Washington, which lasted well into the 20s and 30s. However, if you wished to record and you were from Washington, it was truly necessary for you to leave Washington to get a recording gig. With a small exception of this wonderful record by Elder Lightfoot Solomon Michaud, which was broadcast over the Columbia Network and recorded by RCA Victor. Now, as we come into the wartime period, many speakers here have already talked to the difficulty of making records during the war, shellac rationing and the musician strike, so records became in generally short supply. There's one other aspect I'd like to mention, and that's the Office of Price Administration, which during the war controlled the prices of consumer goods across the spectrum. Records were included, so that when you see old sleeves and you see these ceiling prices, that's what it's about. That was a tremendous disincentive for people to get into the industry at that point in time. But by the end of the war, people were realizing there was pent-up demand for records, and this advertisement from Super Drug was from 1943, illustrating that demand. Now, the Feld brothers ran Super Drug. They knew that there was a market, and perhaps their most iconic record on their own homegrown label, which was from Washington, even though the early ones say New York City, again, an ego issue, was Guitar Boogie by Arthur Smith. So, Marty, track two, please. That riff, of course, became standard for guitar students throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and on. Now, about this time, there was a young college student, and you might not recognize this individual, but I think you'll recognize this individual as Ahmet Erdogan, the founder of Atlantic Records, who was the son of the Turkish ambassador to Washington. And he was anxious to get into the record business even before he finished college. His first venture was with Herb Abramson, a man who was working at National Records in New York, and they decided that they were going to take a blues singer, have the blues singer do gospel material, and back it with a traditional New Orleans band. Certainly an innovative concept, but not a commercially successful one. So Marty, track three, please. Okay, Their Not So Silent Partner is listed at the bottom of the page for the Record Changer advertisement, the sole advertisement, Quality Records. These records are very scarce. We know that the two Ernestine Washingtons were issued, but I do not believe that any copies of the Gospel Keys records have ever surfaced. That quality tie-in is very important. As their partner, Max Silverman, otherwise known as Waxy Maxy, helped these two individuals launch this record company, and their next venture after Jubilee was called Quality. And in this photograph, you see Max Silverman on the left, Herb Abramson, the two principal performers, Mel Moore and Ernie Fields, and then Stan Kenton, Art Ford, and Ahmet Erdogan. After the failure of both ventures, those masters were sold to Moses Ash in New York, who had, of course, Ash and Disc Records, and they were fortunately reissued. I need to thank my buddy in Honolulu, the Capitol record picker, Shaq Shackelford, for finding this last February. It's not that hard a record to find, but when you want to put your hands on it, it's sometimes difficult. I also wanted to mention that that label, Jubilee, had been used by Herb Abramson, along with Jerry Blaine, to launch the new Jubilee label. So when you think of Jubilee and the Orioles, or Kermit Schaefer, or Rusty Warren, or whoever you think of when you think of Jubilee, the origin goes back to Erdogan and Abramson in 1946. They unfortunately, I think, made a bad choice as to which records to launch Jubilee with, and to my taste, the two Gospel Keys were the much more powerful artists. So Marty, if you could, track four, please. Track four,
you got to move, you got to move, you got to move,
oh, you got to move.
When the Lord gets ready, you got to move. You may be high, you may be low, you may be rich, you may be poor. When the Lord gets ready, you got to move, you got to move. You got to move.
Now, I have to remind you, this is the post-war session, and you're definitely hearing it in the surfaces of those 78s. Now, here's where the connections begin to get a little strange, if not ironic. On the flip side of that record was a record by the Thrasher Wonders. And you're saying, Thrasher, why do I know that name? You know that name because Gerhard and Andrew Thrasher teamed with the Mount Lebanon Singers and Clyde McFadder to form the Drifters in 1943. And who did they record for? Ahmet Erdogan at Atlantic. So this is all becoming very incestuous. Meanwhile, back in Washington, this woman, Lillian Nichol Claiborne, was trying to form her own label. After returning to Washington, she had lived in New York for over 20 years and came back during the wartime years to take care of her parents. I find it very appropriate that her very first effort, which was a Society Band record, was entitled Moment of Madness. And certainly that title was a leitmotif for her 25 years in the record business. But as she was launching, she was very dependent on communications with a man named Ned Reel in Manhattan. And Ned was launching a scheme of his own called the Song of the Month Club. And I need to thank Alan Sutton and Dave Barron for providing me with a great deal of correspondence that they happened to find out in Denver when Ned Reel's daughter's estate was about to go into the dumpster. So it was saved. Song of the Month, if you were an aspiring songwriter, you would submit your lyric to Ned Reel, and he would finish writing the music. He would take it into studio, have a real New York City band perform it in a New York City studio, and then press up 50 or 100 copies of those records and print sheet music for you and send it all back to you at a price. At the same time, he was sending it to other members of the Song of the Month Club, regardless of whether they were interested in it or not. So all very complicated, but quite a schema to get things going here. One of her first successful records was again by a New York Society band leader, Bill McCune, and it's a novelty song. So Marty, if you could, track 5.
Once there was a little cricket, wicked, wicked little cricket. Mama said, don't touch that thicket, but into the thick, thick thicket ran he with the nippity-wickety. Through the little brow he would crawl with the nippity-wickety. Through the little brow he would crawl. There was honey
Faye,
in
please?
The
yeah. Now, to my ear, although that might be classified as a children's song, certainly not a contemporary song for late 1947, which might explain why Mrs. Claiborne was constantly struggling. Meanwhile, up in New York, Abramson and Erdogan got serious, and they actually capitalized with money from Dr. Vahdi Sabit, Ahmet's dentist, and their first trade ads appeared in April of 1948. Meanwhile, back at D.C., Mrs. Claiborne was trying to keep things going. And before I read this quote from her, I want you to remember she was born in 1898 in Winchester, Virginia, and her words very much reflect that background. She talks about recording with the Quintones, and she says, then we'll record a record with a colored singer, as we must make some money some way, and that is the easiest way, to have a colored singer and sell to the colored record stores, as they are the only ones now buying and selling records, and the record business is very slow. I think curious comments, I thought in 1947 the record business was actually on the rebound, but she was having her hard luck and she knew she needed to move into different markets in order to be successful. The person she had record was a man named Bill Dillard, and for those of you schooled in jazz, you go Bill Dillard, of course, the trumpet player, Paris, 1930s. Not a major star, but well known. Unfortunately, that record has yet to surface, and this record with a group called the Progressive Four that we'll talk about next, is the only one that survives. Now here's where the twist gets strange again. Bill Dillard, it turns out, because of his time in Paris, was the man asked to escort Leadbelly, a Moses Ash artist, back to Paris to do his European tour in 1949, shortly before Leadbelly passed away. Now I'm gonna move on to the Progressive Four, a very talented group stemming from the group that recorded for Columbia in Atlanta in 1931, several new members and a new style. By this time, Mrs. Claiborne was working with Ivan Balin of Gotham in Philadelphia, which I believe he bought from Sam Goody in New York, which is why Gotham is in Philadelphia, but that's how it was for the late 40s into the 1950s. And they were able to work a deal with Herman Lubinsky at Savoy, wherein the Progressive Four were placed on Savoy when Herman launched his 4,000 series gospel. So, Marty, track 6, please.
Oh, well, I dream of a city called heaven, so bright and so fair. As I entered the city, I cried, holy Lord, the angels all met me there, and they carried me from mansion to mansion. Lord, but oh, the sight I saw. Lord, I bowed on my knees to give praises to the one who died for us all.
Well, you know I bowed down on my knees and cried holy to the Lamb. I cried holy to the Lamb. I cried holy to the Lamb. Well, I clapped my hands and cried holy, holy to the Lamb, Lamb of God.
Marty, go ahead and fade now. To my ears, one of the best records to come out of Washington during that period of time, and sadly, very rarely heard today. This is the way it worked. The records first came out on DC in 48, And then in 49, they were picked up by Savoy. The Red record was mastered by Melodisc in France from an original 78, I will say poorly mastered, and distributed in England. And the Green record was distributed throughout South America. Now, let's back to our friends, the Feld brothers. In 1948, you of course remember that was the second American Federation of Musicians recording ban, and the Feld brothers received an offer they couldn't refuse, and that was to sell all of their masters to MGM, a major label which had tried to launch in the face of the recording ban. So ostensibly, the Felds in one swoop were out of the business, except for this. They had a little label called Scoop. And I'd like to play one country example. You'll notice in the center, Bill Grammer and his Shenandoah Mountain Boys. Well, that's Billy Grammer, as in Gotta Travel On. And please note the songwriter, Kay Adelman. So track 7, please. Okay, it's not coming up, all right, we'll skip over that, thank you. Now jumping up to 1950, our friends at Atlantic were also trying to get diversified in their label, and they came up to Washington to record Bill Grammer and his band at WWDC. And once again, look at the songwriter, Adelman Mesteski. Ben Adelman, to those of us around Washington today, know of him as a man who recorded the best of Washington's bluegrass. But he, in fact, had a songwriting career going back to the 1920s, and when I went to the Library of Congress, I was amazed to find inches of file cards in the copyright catalog attributed to Ben Adelman in each of the different segments that the catalog is broken into. Now, the one real formal transaction between DC and Atlantic was shown here. But what I'd like to do, if it will come up, is track 8, please.
Through the patrol, closer to the curb, grandmother can't step that high. Grandmother's usually so quiet, sorry she started that riot. Now how she got out of hand, I can't understand. All she had was 7 quarts of rye. Roll a patrol closer to the curb. My grandmother can't step that high.
Okay, if that photograph is kind of bugging you because you see somebody you recognize but can't quite name, upper right corner, Jimmy Dean, Sausage King. And he was playing the accordion on that record. Now, the Atlantic deal, one of the few formal transactions between DC and Atlantic, fortunately recorded in short notes in the Billboard, April 8, 1950. Atlantic has taken over masters by the Howington Brothers and the Tennessee Haymakers, still working at the Dixie Pig in Washington, D.C. Aside, Jimmy Dean described that as a bucket of blood, formerly with DC Records. So a lot said in that short little clip. The last little interaction that I've documented between Atlantic and DC is this one. Those of you that know 50s music know Shaboom by the Chords, a major hit in the summer of 1954, kind of an iconic 1950s record recorded by this group out of New York City. Unfortunately, Atlantic didn't do their research because Mrs. Claiborne had a group of chords that recorded for Jem, again of New York City, in September of 1953. They were a subsidiary of Discovery on the West Coast. So again, these swirling connections. And she was able to successfully enjoin Atlantic from reusing the name Chords. They changed their name to the Chord Cats and the Shabooms and never had another hit. And Lil Ann's group never had another hit. So to wrap things up quite briefly here, you remember that young visionary record entrepreneur and his attempt to fuse gospel music with popular black music. Think about how that advanced. Clyde McFadder and the Drifters with Clyde's gospel-styled vocals over a standard vocal group in developing the R&B sound in 53, 54, 55, and then finally onto Ray Charles and his successful gospel-styled vocals of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. As far as the Feld brothers, when they got out of the record business, they went into show business, and they made a lot of money such that by 1967 they were able to buy Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. And then what about our friend Mrs. Claiborne? Well, at long last, she and Ben Edelman finally had their hit with the lead singer from the Progressive Four, Harmon Bethea, shown here as Masked Man and the Agents, doing Comedy Funk Records in 1969. Two of these records did, in fact, chart and were both on the rhythm and blues and pop charts in 1969. That concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Fascinating, Jay. If I find any of those labels, I'll let you know.